You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Hey, listeners, and welcome back to National Security Law Today. Last week, we kicked off our conversation with Dr. Karush Shirvan, professor at MIT's Department of Nuclear Science and Engineering, to break down the fundamentals of nuclear energy, how it compares to coal, and what it takes to bring new facilities online. This week, we shift the focus to the future. Alisa and Dr. Shirvan discuss what's holding the U.S. back in the global race for nuclear innovation, how emerging reactor technologies are changing the game, and why affordability, infrastructure, and smart policy will shape the path forward. As always, thanks for tuning in, and here's Alisa.
Let's talk about this. One of the things that's been discussed almost daily, any newspaper you pick up, they talk about these small-scale nuclear reactors. And we have had a guest who talked a little bit about, you know, the Defense Project Pele. Can you talk about what is necessary or different about these small-scale reactors? Because when I hear small-scale, I have a concern that they're also developed more quickly. Maybe when I'm sitting on the highway, you know, that truck in front of me has one on the back and I don't know it. Are these things really useful? And exactly what are they capable of doing that is an advantage over any large existing reactor?
Yeah, and this is where we as a community love to confuse everyone, because the terms SMR, small reactor, micro reactor, nuclear battery, portable, nuclear rocket, I mean, we got all these terms. Really, you know, I like to break it down to, you know, nucleus for land, nucleus for sea, nucleus for space. And there's now all three of these domains being under development by the U.S. government as well as private industry. For the land one, predominantly when you hear a small modular reactor, the word small refers to the power output of the reactor. In fact, when we started the nuclear industry, all the reactors were small in power output and we scaled up. So the proposal is to go back, kind of reverse, to a smaller one because they'll have a less total money that you need to finance. However, as we've seen at the beginning of the nuclear industry and other countries have seen recently, as they've scaled up their reactor technology, they're going to be more costly. As you mentioned earlier, you know, we're a capitalistic society, so hard to believe that any of these smaller reactors will find a commercial foothold without massive government support. In fact, you know, a lot of these small reactors, their footprints are actually even larger than our existing large reactors. So you definitely don't have to worry about any fast development or, you know, rapid prototyping or anything like that.
Nobody in nuclear says move fast and break things.
Yeah. You don't have to worry about that. With us, we go at turtle speed. However, there is now proposals for these reactors to make like on the sea for commercial shipping or a floating platform to power an oil rig, decarbonize the power production of creating carbon. You know, there are those applications, particularly driven that Europeans recently put a carbon tax if you're having on ships, on maritime. So there, you know, the question becomes, you know, what do you do? You know, if a group of pirates come and steal your ship, did you just give nuclear fuel to the adversaries? So those are things that are not really being addressed yet. We do have projects at MIT and other folks have projects to try to address, you know, what this would look like. But that's where, you know, people are concerned for right reasons of now you have a mobile reactor. Now we have more mobile reactors out there than than land reactors in form of submarines and aircraft carriers. But those systems have a lot of weaponry protecting them.
Let's talk about the green alternatives, wind and solar. Is there any way for all these things to sort of intersect and create sort of this carbon-free world that we imagine? What are your thoughts about nuclear's role in sort of being part of something that could be better than oil and gas, assuming we didn't have oil and gas lobbyists and countries that, you know, their entire GDP depended on it? Could we do something like that eventually?
Yeah. When you try to model the electric grid for a particular grid system, particular state, you know, region in the U.S., hour by hour, you immediately see that, you know, solar and wind, as well as battery storage, can play a large role in those grids, up to 30, 40%, maybe in some cases, depending on the region, if you have like pretty good, you know, sunshine, can play maybe to up to 50%. But then it becomes clear for your critical infrastructure to combat black swan events, to combat global crises. We seem to have many of them. You know, you have to have that firm, reliable, dispatchable power that you can depend on. Now, this is where nuclear comes into play because it can be dispatchable. It can also follow loads. You know, in France, more than 50% of their electricity comes from nuclear and they can follow the load as well. So you can have a grid with 70% nuclear and 15% hydro and 15% solar and wind plus battery. That's perfectly fine. But you need to, at minimum, you need to have that 30 to 50% of reliable power, depending on the region, you know, again, you are, what kind of renewable resources you can access. So if we are into a low carbon world, we have to invest in technologies like nuclear, geothermal. A lot of people, you know, like to also put carbon capture in that category. I'm a little bit more skeptical because once you capture the carbon, you have to sequester it. And there's very few sites in the US that are actually good. So you can actually put carbon underground. And the technology, honestly, it seems like it's going to lower the efficiency and reliability of the system enough that it may not be able to play a big role. For those reasons, you know, nuclear continues to be of interest. Unfortunately, the way things are looking, we are basically want to pump in lots of renewable, lots of intermittent sources, shut down cheaper existing coal plants or gas plants, and increase the price of electricity to a point that, you know, then nuclear becomes affordable and becomes the solution instead of looking at how we can bring the cost down with nuclear by investing in right technologies and right policies.
You mentioned France has 70%, did you say, they're dependent on nuclear? Yeah. How do we compare to other countries than France? And is there anything unique about the United States, not just culturally, but maybe some other reason why it is that we can't go to a level of, say, France?
So we're at, you know, 20%, close to 19% now, technically. But back in the 70s and 80s, we had actually enough projects ongoing, more than 200 projects that were abandoned. And if those more than 200 projects were actually finished, we were going to be at the France 70% level. But what happened was those projects realized post the Three Mile Island accident, the way you regulate nuclear changed, as well as energy demand slowed down. And on top of that, the projects were also realizing construction delays, partly because of regulatory changes, as well as just mismanagement of resources spreading thin across many projects. So they were abandoned. So now the question is, why don't we redo what we were going to do in the 70s to decarbonize? And it comes down to cost. Those plans back then were economical. Today, they're meeting with a beast called a combined cycle natural gas plant. A combined cycle natural gas plant not only did not exist back in the 70s, but gas prices also were not nearly as cheap with a fracking boom that happened in the early 2000s that completely collapsed down gas prices in the US.
I was talking to Jeff Waxman. One of the things that he said was, you know, there are these nuclear power plants in Germany, and I guess under whatever labor laws they have, people have been showing up to work even though they were decommissioned for 30 years. I thought it would make a great novel or screenplay, a story about these people showing up every day and then that they could turn a switch and start these power plants again, you know, and these guys would suddenly be relevant again, which would be a great sort of late career moment for them. I mean, were any of the developments of the 1970s at such a stage that there are things that we could go back in and complete?
Again, it's very important to make this point that, yeah, while new reactors cannot compete with a new combined natural gas plant in the United States, existing reactors can. That's why we're running them. Otherwise, we would shut down the 94 reactors that I mentioned earlier. And, you know, because they've already paid their capital debt, except for the two that we just built, they're running only on, you know, their marginal operating costs and fuel costs. The worst thing you can do in any economy is to shut down your existing reactor after it's paid off its capital cost, because it's profitable, provides you reliable electricity, and is carbon free. And in Germany, hopefully, you know, there'll be enough momentum, again, unlikely, but hopefully there'll be enough momentum that they would restart some of these reactors that they haven't started dismantling. Now, in the US, we already are resurrecting two plants that were recently shut down, the one at the Three Mile Island side. There's one in Palisades. And then there is another one actually in the state of Iowa that there'll be some official announcement on its potential restarting it probably next year. Other plants, more or less, they've been gutted. There is a plant in Alabama, Bellefonte, that was over, I think, even 80% complete, had all the things, but now the utility has been using some parts of it. There is two new plants that were abandoned in VC Summer in South Carolina, was part of this new technology, AP1000. They're about 40% done. So they can be there. People are looking at, actually, the state is looking at restarting it. But outside of these handful, the rest, we have one actually close by in New Hampshire. And the parts have been used in other...
They've been cannibalized. Oh, wow. Okay. But let's talk about, we're looking at a time of autonomous weapons. I mean, watching what's happened in the Middle East has been surprising, predictable, like Star Wars. Everybody's using drones. Do you have a sense of how much the country's national security and military function depends on nuclear power, or may come to depend on nuclear power as our energy needs grow? Because I see AI siphoning off a lot of energy needs just to run these data centers. And on some level, I have concerns that that maybe would render us vulnerable if we needed energy for things like autonomous weapons rather than sending men and women to battle.
Yeah, of course, the facilities that are in the U.S., you know, mainly use the grid. So the grid needs to be reliable. Right now, we have over 40% of our electricity provided by combined natural gas plants because they're the cheapest. So that's the majority source in the U.S. Unlike electricity, where you know, cut a wire and the electricity can just go through the other distribution, you cut a gas pipeline, you're done. So it's very, very dangerous to go over. I've seen some studies say 50, 60% gas becomes very dangerous because it becomes a very easy target for adversaries to do. Now, on the actual field, there is this project by the Army, the Pele program, where it envisioned having these very flexible, deployable reactors that you would just kind of go in with the helicopters, a bunch of things, put them together, maybe power a, you know, high-end railgun. Now, there's been a lot of step back from that vision. You know, these reactors, the fuel itself, you have to like almost treat it like a newborn baby. And so you can't really have these things, you know, move around, fast startup, things like that. You know, the technologies that, you know, at least the Army is pursuing is not really meant for these things. So we're long away from use of these things in an active battlefield. But in terms of providing reliable power for our sensitive infrastructure, I think we do have to take a hard look and make sure that, you know, hydro assets, existing nuclear, as well as if data centers are indeed going to siphon most of our reliable electricity out, we need to add reliable, dispatchable power like nuclear, geothermal onto the grid.
We've talked a little bit about cost. Americans historically have voted on what I'll call home economics issues. And the price of energy, I think, is a big feature of this. When we look at places like France or even Germany right now, we see two things. We see absurdly high costs compared to the United States, despite the prevalence of nuclear power plants in France, obviously not in Germany. They're still sitting idle. What would you say is the key feature of what makes the cost lower here and makes them so much higher there?
You know, there is a retail cost. So let's say you and I live in a household. We have a retail cost we pay. And when we pay that, substantial part of that retail cost is transmission, as well as generation. Now, when it comes to generation cost itself, cost of producing that electricity by the power plant, you look at France compared to Germany, it's night and day. In fact, if you put in about 33 countries in Europe, with the 50 states we have in the US. So on average, if you look at the US, we're doing much better than France and Germany. However, there's lots of parts of Europe that they're not doing too far off from US. And when you put 33 countries and 50 states of US, number one is actually a US state, Hawaii. Germany comes out in top 10. France ends up at 21. California comes out at 8. So California and Germany end up at very high costs. So why is that? California still uses, you know, gas, uses some nuclear, very 10% nuclear, a lot of renewables. Germany uses a lot of coal. So there is the generation cost that definitely factors in, can be 20% to 40% of the total bill cost. And then there is the rest. People commonly know the transmission, but a lot of that cost, how you set transmission cost, depends on how are you paying, you know, how much are you paying your employees? So state of California, you pay them pretty well. In Europe, you actually, the salaries are low, but the government is charging a massive overhead for all the socialist programs that they have, from healthcare, retirement. All these things are actually then carried through on the bill. So in California, you have a lot of low-income programs in the state of California. That actually is part of the bill that you get charged, is factored into that transmission cost. So when you look at it, France is actually generation pretty low thanks to nuclear, plus transmission, you know, 21. It's kind of like a bottom of the top quartile. California and Germany, they're doing really bad because not only the generation is a little bit higher because of the renewable penetration, but also they have all these other programs. So transmission, high pay, that also factors in.
Let's pivot for just a second. One of the things that I think is important for Americans to do, and we don't always do it, but certainly in the national security space, we really try to, and that's to project out. For us, a long way in the future is really 10 years. Now, I recognize more ancient cultures, time is considered, we make plans 50 years, or China has a 100 years plan. Where do you see the future of nuclear as it's naturally going to go over the next couple of decades? And what would be a better projection if you were to be able to control human history?
When it comes to projections, I always, in energy sector, I always like to show these plots of how everyone predicts natural gas prices will go up, you know, back in 20 years ago, natural gas prices will go up in 2010, then 2010 comes in, natural gas prices will come up 2020. So let's say if that's true, that natural gas will not go up in the next 10 years. I don't believe that in this country, we're going to build nuclear in a meaningful fashion. Now, to your question of long-term planning, as I mentioned, that we've proven that these assets with proper refurbishment and regulatory oversight, they can last you 100 years. You look at a natural gas turbine, by the time year 25, 30 hits, you already see degradation in performance. Same thing, wind turbines, by the time year 15, 20, solar panels, by the time year 30 to 35 year hits, you see degradation in these assets. And now you gotta rebuild these assets using real cost in dollars of 10 years from now. So when you account for all these economic features, you see that indeed, given the current prices that we're paying, accounting for not just the generation costs, but also the firm reliability benefits, nuclear makes a lot of sense. If somebody's going to be able to provide, you know, that guaranteed loan that every other country that's building nuclear power plants right now, the government is giving them that loan. So it makes a lot of sense for the government to provide investment in form of guaranteed loans for nuclear, and it makes sense for utilities to think long term. But the reality is we are pretty much privatized. Shareholders, board of directors do not think long-term and short-term. As long as gas prices stay the same price, it's very hard sell.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's hard for boards and CEOs because they get on these earnings calls, they have to file quarterly reports. And it just sounds like, you know, the payoff, the dividend is paid at such a time in the future. And I think in the way you're describing some of it, it's almost a nebulous benefit. It's not even a multifaceted cube or anything. They're just all these secondary, tertiary, and expanding outward benefits, I think, that are not always understandable or easy to explain to shareholders. It's really a shame because you'd like the idea that private industry would see a way forward here, that it would be worth the investment cost. And you tell me things like, you know, replacing a part essentially in one of these silos cracks the thing. And then, you know, it's at billions of dollars of loss. I mean, you seem to think about this in such a topographically diverse way. Have you thought of a way that this specifically a way that, say, Congress could do, not that they would, but let's say they did do something. Is there anything that would be helpful to the development of this technology with a long-term view to benefiting the average person in the United States of America?
The key is the last part you mentioned. What is the benefit to the customer? And the utility and the public commission has to say, when we deploy this project, this is your benefit. And if right now you do it without any government help, it's just going to raise their bill. In my studies, what I've seen is that if you just take the solar and wind subsidies started under the first George Bush administration in the early 2000s, if you take the money that the federal government has spent in solar and wind, you take money that individual states have spent, if you just take that amount of money as an investment tax credit, investment subsidy for already built large-scale new nuclear, then the customer does not see a near-term rate increase. And then after 30 years, when the financing period is done, then the customer would see a massive benefit. And that's the role of the government, is a long-term benefit to its people. And I think this is why the government should not treat nuclear any differently, but give nuclear same chance that they did with solar and wind. And unfortunately, right now, even under Biden administration, the policies were giving the same subsidy to solar and wind as nuclear, but solar and wind has benefited from subsidy by going down learning curves, by having a secure supply chain, versus nuclear right now is just, it's a new technology. We cannot say that, yeah, back in the day, we subsidized them, so we don't subsidize them. We're talking about new, brand new under new regulation. So it needs to have a chance, long-term chance. And I believe that if we are able to subsidize this initial wave to a right level, and that level is no more than what was provided for other carbon-free sources, we can have a very long-term impact for the U.S.
Regarding the acquisition of the uranium that we need, I was a little surprised to hear how much we get from Russia. And I do perceive now, when I hear the president or other people engaged in negotiations with Russia on topics, I do perceive it differently than I did before I understood that we had this dependence. Do you see any ability to shift that? Because I think that could be an issue for a lot of politicians. And certainly it's an issue for people in the national security space. I mean, we worked hard to get off dependence of Russia in aspects of the space program. And I'm certain that we don't want to be dependent on a guy like Putin for what we need to provide our energy needs long term.
Yeah. And we get over 10% of the uranium from Russia, but we get almost 30% of the enriched uranium from Russia as well, mainly because their prices are very good. And what has happened is the Chinese are rapidly expanding their domestic nuclear program, and they're massively draining what supply is there on the market. So we're competing with the Chinese in whatever it's left. Now, thankfully, we have enrichment plan in the U.S., and the company that has these, they're going to make more investment. But the problem is these things take 3 to 5 years. And so we can't have immediately, 30% of the enrichment and 10% of the raw uranium be cut. But at least there is a path to solve this problem. We are already getting most of our uranium from Canada. We can definitely increase that share. We do have some uranium resources in the U.S. So there is a path to solve that problem, but it's something that does take time. But it is unfortunate. And by the way, we get also 25% of uranium in Kazakhstan, which recently agreed with Russia and Chinese to build power plants, and it's under their influence as well. So that's, it's not just Russia that we're depending on.
Well, I'm really glad you came in tonight, and it's great to have an expert of your standing on the podcast. We're very pleased you joined us.
Thank you for having me.
All right. And thank you for listening to NSLT tonight. Our guest has been Dr. Karush Shirvan of the Center of Advanced Nuclear Systems at MIT. He's got a very long CV. He's obviously a very accomplished person. We'll place it in the notes to the podcast if you're interested. Please be sure to subscribe and give us a rating on your listening app of choice. Remember, you should like and share this podcast with other people who might be interested in energy and national security. If you're in national security and you're not interested in energy, you really should be. We're committed to bringing you cost-free, intelligent content that will enrich you and make you the smart person at the party or at the conference table on the Hill or in any conversation with just your friends and brilliant colleagues here in Washington or elsewhere in the United States. Be sure to share this episode with a friend. And remember, when you are talking about these issues, let's do what we're not always doing in the United States of America right now. Let's actually listen to each other, hear one another's opinions and arguments. And remember, if you're a lawyer, if you're not listening to other people's arguments, you're never going to cut it. That's what I have to say. You've got to be able to listen to other people's points of view. Our writer, producer, and host is me, Elisa Poteet. I'm always here in my individual capacity. Our editor and my co-producer is the lovely Frances Burkham. My other co-producer is our lovely director, Holly McMahon, along with the very brilliant members of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security, without whom this podcast would not be possible. We'll see you next time for more on energy and national security.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.